From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. World leaders converged on Paris today to begin talks on climate change, the world's greatest threat. The heads of 150 nations spelling out their visions of what an answer to climate change should look like. They are bringing commitments to Paris to cut back on greenhouse gases and more. There's a sense of hope, but also a sharp understanding of just how steep a climb this is going to be. This hour on Point, the Paris climate talks and what's coming, what's needed. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What do you want to hear out of Paris? Will we get it together to stave off the worst, to do our best? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Among those gathering in Paris today, President Obama and the leader of China. Here first, Obama.
I believe, in the words of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., that there is such a thing as being too late. And when it comes to climate change, that hour is almost upon us. But if we act here, if we act now, if we place our own short-term interests behind the air that our young people will breathe and the food that they will eat and the water that they will drink and the hopes and dreams that sustain their lives, then we won't be too late for them.
Won't be too late. And here's the Chinese President Xi Jinping saying China will peak its emissions by 2030.
In its intended nationally determined contributions, China pledges to peak CO2 emissions by around 2030 and strive to achieve it as soon as possible.
We're going to look at what's coming into Paris, what is hoped for to come out of Paris today. Joining us first from Paris, John Cushman, editor and reporter for Inside Climate News. John Cushman in Paris, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being here.
I'm glad to be here.
People are coming with commitments. If everybody delivers on those, what would that mean for the future of climate change?
Well, it would bend the curve on climate change, but it wouldn't avoid serious risks. And everybody at this conference understands that. As President Xi put it, this isn't the finish line. It's the beginning of a new race. It's just a new starting point.
Copenhagen was widely seen ultimately as a failure, though a lot happened there. Why do we have this hopeful envelope around Paris?
Well, part of it is that the problem is manifesting itself ever more clearly, and the science is becoming clearer. And so it's quite evident that if we were to follow business as usual, there would be intolerable risks in the generations ahead. And so across the world, leaders and governments are recognizing this, and the clock is ticking. Time is running out, not this week or next week, but the clock is definitely running fast on climate change.
Is everyone expecting that all these leaders, and there are so many countries represented here, are in fact going to commit by the end of these 2 weeks to what's been hammered out already, the EU cutting emissions by 40% from 1990 levels, the U.S. cutting emissions by 26-28%, China agreeing that its emissions will peak by 2030. Are these certain commitments at this point?
Well, nothing is ever certain, but as we stand here today, more than 180 countries have produced climate pledges. And to varying degrees, they are spelled out with more or less persuasiveness. But taken together, they do account for 95% of the world's emissions today. And one of the premises of the whole UN process is that different countries have different responsibilities and different obligations and different needs and different realities. And so it's a big, complicated process. But nobody at the UN is trying to produce a top-down solution that each and every country of the world would be sworn to achieve. There are many unknowns. We don't know how fast new technologies are going to arise. We don't know how fast the populations will change, how much economic growth there will be. And we don't know how much political will and political commitment will arise. And so it's really not going to be for another 15 years, not 15 days from now, that we know whether the Paris conference has been a success.
In those 15 days, John, what are the potential landmines?
Well, there are several. It's a big problem to for the developed countries to demand of the developing countries that they pay up for the costly process of bringing down their emissions just when they're trying to bring their people out of poverty. And so the funding for adaptation and for mitigation, you know, mitigation means you turn out the lights when you leave the room, and adaption means that you put up sandbags to avoid the flood.
Yep.
But either of those approaches is expensive. And so it's a big question whether the developed countries, the richer countries, can cough up the amount of money that they've pledged, which is $100 billion a year by the year 2020, or the much greater amount that's certain to be needed in the future. And that's one of the biggest obstacles to getting the poorer countries to sign on.
India will be there. Prime Minister Modi, they're saying not enough. Is India a swing vote here? What actually derails this? If it gets derailed, does it take one country, a group of countries? Could it fail?
I don't think that that failure is really an option, and it's almost an impossibility at this point. The reason that India is important is that India is going to suffer a lot of consequences of climate change. India is on a growth path that, if uninterrupted, if unaltered, would make it a huge source of CO2 emissions. But bear in mind that India has hundreds of millions of people who have no electricity. India has per capita emissions of carbon dioxide about 1/12 of what the United States has, and about 1/6 of what China or Europe has. And so there's a fundamental sense of fairness that has to be addressed. And the people who are involved in these negotiations do understand that. India is also a land of opportunity when it comes to shifting away from fossil fuels and toward clean fuels. And India is already setting out on a path to emphasize wind and solar, but it's a long, complex process to get India to the point that it needs to get to. All that's really needed at this conference is for India to explain what its part is and for a system to be left behind that allows India and countries like that, along with the rest of the world, to review their performance every now and then and keep bending the curve lower and lower.
Even if everybody brings the packages that they've promised to the table, even if it all goes through, as you and others point out, it will still fall far short of stopping climate change, warming, shy of where it could get seriously difficult for the planet. I mean, potentially absolutely devastating. The numbers are confusing because we have both centigrade and Fahrenheit going on.
Yeah.
As usual, it's 2 degrees centigrade has been put out as the max the planet can take without getting into all kinds of lost cities and lost farmland and starving populations and sort of hell on earth, it's often described. Where would these commitments get us toward that goal? And walk us through the numbers.
All right. Well, let's stick with centigrade for now. The range from 2 degrees centigrade to, say, 6 degrees centigrade runs something like 4 degrees Fahrenheit to 11 degrees Fahrenheit. If we did nothing, if we just maintained business as usual, the planet was really going toward intolerable warming. 6 degrees centigrade is far from trivial. But already the new policies that are being adopted or that have already been adopted, especially by countries like China, the European Union, and the United States, these are the three big players right now, have already pointed us in a direction of, say, 3.5-4 degrees Fahrenheit. That's significant warming. It's above the 2 degrees centigrade benchmark, but it's a move in the right direction. And the process that's being put together in Paris is to try to keep the world continuously moving in the right direction. So nobody should think, and nobody has promised, that this problem is going to be solved as if by waving a magic wand here in Paris this week. but it's important to establish mechanisms to review progress, to reset the agenda, to reset the speedometer, and to just keep progress moving. And that's a realistic objective. Remember that any amount of warming has some effect. Once you get above 2 degrees, you don't fall off a cliff. You just are doing better than 3 degrees, and 3 degrees is better than 4 degrees. So any measure of progress is to be welcomed.
And, of course, everybody's talking about ratcheting up the measures that will be taken in the years beyond this. We'll look more at ratcheting. It's not a treaty. Why is that?
Well, it's not being described as a treaty for U.S. domestic purposes because there's no political support in the Senate for ratification, for the Senate's advice and consent to that. But there are many things that a president can do, an executive agreement that is enforceable, and there's all kinds of laws that are on the books that can be implemented, and it's not necessary to sign a new treaty. The core climate treaty goes back 25 years. It's the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, and it breezed through the Senate.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about climate goals out of Paris on day one of the Paris talks today, looking at what's needed, what's possible, what is likely coming out of Paris. You can join us this hour. Are you tuned in to what's going on in Paris? Are you hopeful? Are you glad you're not in charge of security? And even with all the hoopla over Paris, are we taking this challenge seriously enough? John Jack Cushman joins us, editor and reporter for Inside Climate News. Lots of world leaders flying in to Paris today. President Obama speaking there earlier today about the global warming trend because of human-created climate change.
14 of the 15 warmest years on record have occurred since the year 2000. And 2015 is on pace to be the warmest year of all. No nation, large or small, wealthy or poor, is immune to what this means.
Huge gathering. Almost everybody's there. Russian President Vladimir Putin is there. Here he is speaking through an interpreter about how the effort against climate change should be shared among all countries.
Both developed and developing countries should be involved in the efforts. We think this agreement should be comprehensive and equal for all. We support the long-term goal of the new agreement to limit the growth of temperature by the end of the century.
Vladimir Putin there, the Chinese leader Xi Jinping there, and many, many more. John Cushman, please stand by in Paris. Joining us right now from New York is David Sandilow, professor at the Center on Global Energy Policy at Columbia University, a former acting undersecretary of energy back in 2012, 2013, many years in energy policy with the U.S. He has participated in lots of these big climate events. David Sandilow, thanks very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And with me in the studio, Robert Stavins, professor of business government at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, director of the Harvard Environmental Economics Program. He will be in Paris as of tomorrow. He's with us today. Robert Stavins, thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you, Tom.
David Sandilow, you've been involved in a lot of these. When you look at the evolution of these over the years, Rio, Kyoto, Copenhagen, and all the rest, what do you see this time in Paris?
One difference is the heads of state who are showing up. You know, I was at the first one of these conferences of the parties. It was in Berlin in 1995. There were not heads of state there. Then in Copenhagen in 2009, more than 100 heads of state showed up. It was the largest gathering of heads of state ever outside New York. And then again in Paris today, we have an extraordinary showing. Now that showing is even stronger as a result of the tragic terrorist attacks of a couple of weeks ago. But world leaders are coming together to both speak to climate change and show their resolve against terrorism. It's a very strong political signal.
Everybody feels obligated to show the flag these days, Robert Stavins. What about materially, concretely? Are they bringing to the table what's needed, what's reasonable, given the challenge and the threat?
Well, the promise is very good because of the fact that the coverage that we're already experiencing with countries submitting their plans and actions, the so-called intended nationally determined contributions, or INDCs, already account for 95% of global emissions. And you have to compare that with what the current international agreement is, the Kyoto Protocol, which covers 14% of global emissions,
okay,
which is the European Union and New Zealand. That is a breathtaking change. However, it's only a first step. No one is going to say that this is going to solve the climate change problem.
So what is the optimism about, Robert? Are people desperate to say something optimistic? Or is there reason for people looking out and worried that the planet will fry to think this is more than good PR going on in Paris?
So I think there really is reason for optimism. And can I explain it to you with a metaphor?
Mm-hmm.
You know, someone wants to build a 70-story office tower.
Okay.
And we walk over to the construction site, beautiful sign, 70-story office tower coming. We look over. We see that they've already got two floors up. Pretty nice. We look over. We look at the foundation. And it's 10 feet by 10 feet.
We
don't believe it'll ever be done. That was the Kyoto Protocol. We come back a year later, same promise, 70-story office tower. It's a full square block foundation. That's the Paris Agreement. It's the right foundation for going forward.
David Sandilo, these are voluntary commitments as far as I understand. So, you know, why not just go right for the whole, everything that's needed right now? Why only be committing to a fraction of what people believe is actually going to be required?
You know, Tom, there was big news today already at the first day of the conference.
Okay.
You know, President Obama and 19 world leaders announced Mission Innovation, which is a pledge to double research and development on clean energy budgets over the course of the next 5 years. And in combination with that, Bill Gates, the world's richest man, and 27 other business leaders announced the Breakthrough Energy Coalition to put billions of dollars of new money into clean energy that comes out of those government budgets. So in combination, those two send a powerful signal to the world that there's going to be a lot more money, a lot more opportunity in clean energy, and clean energy innovation is the key to solving global warming. So you know, when you add up what Bob was just talking about in terms with the so-called INDCs, the climate action plans that have already been submitted by national governments, and then these announcements on the first day of the conference, I think you can say that in part this conference is already a success. In part it has already generated momentum. In part it has already helped to lay the foundation that Professor Stavins was just talking about. Now, we're going to need to do more. There's no question this is a marathon. It's not a sprint. But I think the Paris Climate Conference has already delivered a lot, even on its first day.
We've got a lot of questions here, a lot of callers for all three of you. Bob in Fairfield, Iowa. Bob, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. Well, this question or this comment is about the Gates Foundation. And I read an article that in which Bill Gates made a comment. He said, if you're not bringing math skills to the problem of climate change, then representative democracy is a problem. And it was very interesting to me. And I'd like to hear about that, about this whole intersection of science, politics, and climate change and the climate deniers. Thank you. I'll take it. Off the year.
Bob, thanks for your call. John Cushman, how about it? Bill Gates there saying, let's get some of the hot air politics out of this and look coldly at the numbers. And the numbers are pretty daunting. Do you see a political readiness in the U.S. globally sufficient to address the actual science that's in front of us here?
Well, I would say a couple of things. One, Bill Gates' involvement is, of course, very important. He may be the richest man in the world, but he doesn't have $45 trillion, and that's the amount of shifted investment that needs to swing from dirty fuels to clean fuels. So why would that happen? Well, one reason is the governments of the world are beginning to understand, or more completely understand, that it's much more expensive to do nothing than it is to do something here, that the faster we act and the more aggressively we act, the lower the pain will be that's inflicted down the road. And finally, I would say there's a growing awareness, a growing consensus. It may not quite encompass the United States yet, that putting a price on carbon emissions is the essential ingredient, and that once you stop making it free to put carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, then marketplaces and innovators and consumers will drive you towards solutions. I think Rob Stavins is, of course, much more qualified than I am to talk about that. On the political level, the problem is that we have, among all the world's democracies, I think uniquely, a legislative majority which is actively trying to tank this project. And the Republicans in Congress have made it quite clear that they're going around telling other leaders of the world that they're going to make sure that the United States does not live up to any commitments that are made here. And that is a terrible obstacle toward a fruitful outcome of these talks.
We'll look at how that might play through what's going on in Paris. Definitely people are talking about the cost of inaction, including President Obama in Paris today.
Submerged countries, abandoned cities, fields that no longer grow, political disruptions that trigger new conflict, and even more floods of desperate peoples seeking the sanctuary of nations not their own. That future is not one of strong economies, nor is it one where fragile states can find their footing. That future is one that we have the power to change.
President Obama in Paris and in Harrisonburg, Virginia. Anne, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. Your last speaker could not be more on target here. We've got to get beyond fear of the GOP and what they can do to our goals and setting goals and fulfilling those goals. One of my heroes, Lester Brown, in World on the Edge, published back in 2011, pointed out how much instability climate change was contributing to nations whose economies were already declining. Thomas Friedman documented that farmers went off to fight in Syria and became the basis of ISIS because of a four-year drought. We've got Puerto Rico on the verge of bankruptcy now, and they've been in the same drought California's been experiencing.
And we get it. You can look around the world and see evidence of the material impact already in lots of places, and not mild impacts either. Robert Stavins, what about it? How do you interpret ongoing political resistance to embracing and solving this issue in this country, in the United States?
Well, so in the United States, Tom, we have a history that action on environment has been from the bottom up. Our five major environmental statutes, all of those came as a result of a real or perceived disaster that then led to public demand, cover stories in Time and Newsweek magazine, and congressional action.
But we've had plenty of disasters in recent years. Superstorm Sandy and all the rest. It's not hard to look around the world and see problems. Anne's pointing them out.
But there's a big difference. So when the Cuyahoga River caught on fire in 1969, yep, led to the Clean Water Act 18 months later, the Cleveland Plain Dealer the next morning didn't write, quote someone, saying, well, rivers periodically catch on fire for natural causes, because we know they don't. But none of us, including the caller, including you and me, none of us observe the climate. We observe the weather. And the variation of the weather day to day, year to year, is vastly greater than the change of climate that we're experiencing, even though that climate change is severe. Mm-hmm. That means that there's a real signal-to-noise ratio problem, if you will. That's a challenge for representative democracy from the bottom up, which is why my view is that it really does require enlightened political leadership from the top.
David Sandel, I'm looking here at the Wall Street Journal today, and on page one, you know, we've had a long history of people throwing doubt on climate change, the reality of it. On page one, here we are in 2015, beginning of the Paris climate talks, and they're talking about scientists disputing the 2-degree centigrade limit on that has been said should be as far as we go in warming the planet. Is this another example of pay no attention to that warming planet talk?
You know, by the way, 2 degrees centigrade is 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit.
Yep.
And it's worth doing the translation for all the Americans out there,
yep,
listening. It is. And look, I think that climate denial is dangerous. The more we cast doubt on the consensus finding of scientists, the more trouble we're going to be in, the more difficult it's going to be to summon the political determination to address this problem. That's happening in the United States today. And the results are potentially tragic for ourselves and for our children. We are already seeing the worst effects of global warming. Science.
I don't think so. I don't think we're already seeing the worst effects of global warming. I think we'll see much worse effects if it goes on.
Yeah, fair enough. But we are already seeing severe droughts and floods. We're seeing heat waves. We're seeing storms that are lethal. We are seeing terrible effects of global warming today. And as you just accurately said, it's only going to get worse. And we need to be innovating, and we need to be deploying clean energy. And the good news, Tom, is we can do that. We can do that while we grow our economy, and the evidence is in on that.
Chris in Tiffin, Ohio. Chris, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah, I'm a dissenter here in the group, I guess. It sounds like everyone's pretty much in agreement.
What do you got, Chris?
I don't agree with us committing to any agreements where China does no cutting. They have already gotten our jobs, gotten our capital, and you want the American people in a weak economy to pay forward for this. And I just don't agree with that at all.
When you hear the Chinese president saying that they will top out their growth in greenhouse gases by 2030, which means hitting the brakes in a pretty strong way in China, does that not persuade you, Chris?
No, that's just a statement. That's a statement that president will be dead in 2030.
Well,
there'll be a new president there, and who's to say that they're going to live up to what China's agreement? Why isn't China cutting right now, then?
Well, I mean, we'll look at that, but we'll also have a new president, many new presidents before 2030, and it's the U.S. that's keeping this from being a binding treaty. But fair enough. Let us look at it. Robert Stavins, doubt about whether others will live up to the commitments made in Paris, China in particular there from...
Well, Chris raises an important point. And if you think back to the time of the Kyoto Protocol when the U.S. Senate voted 95-0 in advance in a resolution saying that they would not support it.
No way, no how.
Exactly. And the reason is because China, India, Brazil, Korea, the major now emerging economies weren't included.
But they're not exempted this time.
This is the answer to it, though. Now they are not exempted. They are included. China's included. Now, it's true, as Chris points out, that the contribution that China has stated is different than the United States. Ours is different, not as ambitious as Europe. That's a fundamental principle of the overall framework convention, common but differentiated responsibilities.
And why?
Because we're all in it together, but some of us historically have contributed more than others, principally the United States.
You mean have contributed
gases to
climate change because we're still the net biggest over through history emitter of greenhouse gases.
That's right. So we're number one in terms of cumulative emissions. Mm-hmm. China is number one in terms of annual emissions. And they'll catch up with us in cumulative emissions in a decade or two, depending upon economic growth rates.
The president talked about that in Paris this morning, saying, look, acknowledging the U.S. Played a big, big role in where the planet stands now.
I've come here personally as the leader of the world's largest economy and the second largest emitter to say that the United States of America not only recognizes our role in creating this problem, we embrace our responsibility to do something about it.
John Cushman, there's past and present there. The biggest net contributor, but the second largest emitter now. And Chris calling from Ohio is right. China is number one. What about the commitment that China is making here?
Yes, well, China is making a large commitment, and in fact, they're backing out of their fossil fuel growth in a really remarkable way already, largely because 1 million Chinese are dying every year from the other pollution that comes from burning coal. But the fact is, the world has already gotten 1 degree centigrade warmer, and most of the carbon that did that was burned by the United States and the United Kingdom.
On Point is sponsored by Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses made in America. They're engineered for comfort and long-lasting support with just the right sink, just the right bounce. Two technologies, latex foam and memory foam, come together for better nights and brighter days. It's outrageous comfort at a polite price. Here's the great part. You can try one risk-free for 100 days with free delivery and returns. Go to casper.com/onpoint. That's casper.com/onpoint. And remember to use promo code ONPOINT at checkout to receive a special offer. Terms and conditions apply.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about climate goals out of Paris on day one of the Paris talks today. We're looking at what's needed, what's possible, what's coming from Paris. With John Cushman, editor and reporter for Inside Climate News, he is in Paris. Robert Stavins is headed there tomorrow. He's director of the Harvard Project on Climate Agreements. David Sandilow has attended many of these big conventions, some of them more successful than others. This time, he's watching very knowledgeably out of Columbia University in the Global Energy Policy Center there. You can join us this hour. Are you hopeful the world will get its act together on climate change? Are we still fiddling while the future burns? What's your question, your prediction, your hope for Paris? Talking with NPR's All Things Considered last week, this was Cristiana Figueres. She's executive secretary of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, saying it can be done.
We have most of the technology that we need. We have the capital. We're moving on the policy. We just need to focus and understand the urgency of this. And yes, I do think that we as humanity will be able to address this challenge.
Is there skepticism out there? You bet there's plenty. Here's Michael Bloomberg, former New York City mayor. He's now a special envoy for the UN Secretary General for Cities, saying the U.S. is often the one that has held back progress.
America's never going to approve any treaty. I mean, we're the ones that you really should look in. We should look ourselves in the mirror and say, wait a second. You know, we go to all these conferences, and we're the one country that says, sorry, we can't sign anything.
We've got callers from all over. Laura in Des Moines, Iowa. Laura, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Thanks, Tom. So here in Iowa, of course, we're landlocked, and I've been chatting with friends about how as the sea waters rise, what will that mean for migration here in the United States, and how will that look in 10 and 20 years as people are moving away from coastal areas and moving in? And of course, that would be great for our state because we sort of have a brain drain. But the other part of it is all these presidential nominees coming in through Iowa.
Sure.
And we all always like to meet them. You know, I'm a Democrat, but I do like to, you know, look people in the whites of their eyes, even if they're Republicans. And so we are, folks I know and my family are asking them about the climate pledge, and are they willing to sign on to the climate pledge, which is sort of the same one that they want people, countries to sign on to today and tomorrow in Paris.
And what are you hearing in response, Laura?
Well, we did an action at Carly Fee Arena's small gathering at Grinnell High School about a month ago, and my daughter stood up and asked and said, hey, you know, would you be willing to sign this pledge? And do you believe in climate change? And what do you, as a presidential nominee and businesswoman, you know, what do you think about this? And she poo-pooed it. And I thought that was interesting because the largest business in America is the military, and they are on board. They're seeing it when they go out there in the world. And the third thing, sorry, Tom, it's taking so long, is that I've got a friend, Ed Fallon, who is in France, and he walked from Normandy to Paris for these talks, and he's there today.
A lot of people in France right now, Laura, and I appreciate your call from Iowa. Robert Stavins, we hear that the most important thing is to put a price on carbon. The U.S. tried to do that, didn't work out here. China is now doing that? Is that right?
Well, so there's action in both countries. So it's true that China has six pilot schemes in place, cap and trade systems at the provincial and city level. And President Xi announced together with President Obama back in September at the White House that they were in the year 2017 going to put in place a national carbon cap and trade system.
China will.
China. At the same time in the United States, remember, we have a significant cap and trade system operating, carbon pricing mechanism in California. And that's a big part of the U.S. economy. In the Northeast, we have the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. And now the administration's new regulatory action, the Clean Power Plan, is probably going to foster a significant number of cap and trade systems linked together across the country, essentially the blue states. That's where you're going to see the action in the U.S.
So some threads of cap and trade or limits on carbon even here. John Cushman, where are you going to look in the course of this next 2 weeks to see whether Paris is maximizing its impact or not?
Well, I think that the critical bit is to make sure that at least the process of constant review and constant increase in ambition is established in a way that's forceful and effective and transparent, and that it as its part of the agreement will be binding, that countries will agree that we're all in this together and that we're all going to approach the problem in a common way, even though each country is different. And by doing so, we'll have firmly established a world in which all nations are addressing their responsibilities to do something about climate. There is a 2-degree target. Some people say it should be 1.5 degrees Celsius target as a guardrail or a line that's not to be crossed. But the reality is, whatever limit you set as a target for the maximum temperature increase in the century ahead, any limit, 3 degrees, 4 degrees, any limit requires eventually that the whole world stop emitting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. You've got to get to a zero objective one way or another. And that's the other big accomplishment of Paris, to get the whole world to agree to a process and to get the whole world to understand that someday, and before too long, we have to get to zero emissions. These are huge accomplishments. And it then requires, starting on day one and continuing for 15 years and beyond, real worldwide dedication to getting the job done.
David Sandilo, you can understand why a lot of people may be worried about eyewash coming out of Paris. There's a lot of hope being expressed here, and that is encouraging. But these steps are not all easy at all. Many of them will be politically difficult. Of course, everyone wants to see new technology, new energy sources. But what's your level of confidence that this, what they call the ratchet, this commitment to ratcheting up measures to rein in climate change over time, will be truly embraced and will stick, David?
It's low. Look, this convention has a feature which makes it extremely hard to reach agreement. And I think all the listeners should understand this, that in order for any agreement to be reached under the Framework Convention on Climate Change, all or almost all countries must agree. Now, in the U.S. Senate, you know, people pull their hair out because there's a 60-vote requirement. But in this convention, essentially everybody needs to agree. And that makes any type of decision extremely challenging. So I hope that with a small miracle at the end of this conference, we're going to see agreement on the points that Jack was just talking about, including review procedures. But it's not going to be easy. I do think that the people who are running this conference have done a brilliant job of creating a success even before we get to the last day, that with the submission of all these national climate action plans and then these really stunning announcements today on clean energy innovation, this conference has already delivered an important success in helping to address the problem of climate change. Not enough for sure. We're going to need to do much more, but it's already delivered some important successes.
Robert Stavins, we want success, and we want to acknowledge where we see it, but we don't want happy talk. We don't want to be shined on and suddenly another 10 years, another 20 years has gone by. This is getting harder all the time. Where are you going to look for signs that there's actual, dependable traction in the works here?
So I've got my scorecard of five items mm-hmm. that would spell success to me. Number one has already been achieved. That was that more than 90% of global emissions are accounted for. We're now at 95%.
Could you explain that once more? More than 90% accounted for
in terms of these contributions, these submissions, official submissions from the countries, these so-called INDCs.
So 90% will be brought down one way or another by these commitments. Not a 90% reduction, but 90% are part of the picture.
Yes, no, the reduction is certainly not 90%,
right.
But rather that the countries that have agreed mm-hmm. to participate, mm-hmm. unlike the Kyoto Protocol, which was 14%,
right. Okay.
This is 95%.
Everybody's in the pool almost.
Exactly. So that's the foundation, okay. The one square block.
Mm-hmm.
Number two is that there is a credible reporting and verification mechanism. The United States,
the review that David was
talking
about.
Exactly. And that it be at some period of time, which would be number three, that it be about 5 years.
I mean, because China has been making these claims about what it's doing, and then boom, they come out with a new report that's saying there's 17% more coal power plant pollution than they had earlier said.
And that's precisely, Tom, why it's important that there be some kind of credible transparency. China is moving in that direction. Mm-hmm. I believe that by the end of the talks, China will be on board with the U.S. There's going to be consensus between these two major emitters. There may be other countries that are causing problems with it. A third of the five is to set up a credible finance mechanism, this $100 billion.
Per year, two poorer nations in the world to help them to pay for the carbon they won't use and help them find alternative energy sources?
Well, it's for two reasons. One is the mitigation, yes. Mm-hmm. The other is for adaptation because mm-hmm. climate change is going to take place.
Them. Mm-hmm.
And then fifth and finally of these is that the delegates need to put aside what I consider to be some unproductive disagreements, which could actually blow up the talks. There are two of them. One is there's a lot of talk since going back to the negotiations that took place in Warsaw several years ago mm-hmm. of so-called loss and damage. The principle that the rich countries should be essentially compensating countries for loss and damage due to climate change.
That they've already suffered.
And they will be. Mm-hmm. The United States and other rich countries look at that kind of provision and what they see is unlimited legal liability for bad weather. And they just can't accept it. I think that some of the – but you could understand that small island states, for them, provision is very important.
Yeah.
That's going to be a big friction that has to be addressed. And then the final one of these that could blow it up would be the legal nature of the agreement. What the United States wants, as we've been discussing because of the problem of Senate ratification, is a binding international agreement, but that the specific targets that are in the INDCs themselves should not be legally binding. That's up to each country. Europe has been pushing for making those bindings, but they're beginning to back down.
John Cushman, in Paris, what about this loss and damage front? Do you see evidence that vulnerable, poorer countries are going to want cash for weather-related catastrophes that they face now and in the future?
I think that what they're likely to do is to reaffirm the Warsaw commitment that Rob just mentioned, but leave it up to a future date to work out the mechanism for that so that they won't abandon the thought entirely, mm-hmm. but that time has not come. It's actually much more productive for wealthier countries to assist poorer countries in adaptation and in building resiliency, which is a role that the wealthier countries have played in many ways over the years. As to the form of the agreement, the legal form of the agreement, I think that it is the case. Even France has come out and now as the host party and said that the commitments themselves need not be binding. I'm sure there's a way that at the end of the day that the delegates will find a way to split their differences on that score. There's another requirement, though, that needs to go ahead. And coming out of Paris, there needs to be a continuation of the kind of mass popular movement to demand of our leaders that we address this very significant problem, which we're not going to suffer the worst effects of climate change. But I think that by the time my granddaughter is my age, the worst effects of climate change will be seen all over the world. And just as responsible citizens of the world, we have to demand of our leaders that they address this problem. This has been done in the past with huge marches and with other kind of popular movements. Here in Paris, we couldn't have the huge march, but there was a very moving scene over the weekend of empty shoes lining the Place de la République, I believe it was, thousands and thousands of empty shoes to symbolize the people who would have been in the streets of Paris in a peaceful call for government action. And those protests occurred all over the world. I think the mobilization of political support for addressing this problem on behalf of the next generation and the generation after that is the most critical element of all.
Poll out over the weekend, CBS New York Times says two-thirds of Americans support the U.S. joining a binding international agreement to curb the growth of greenhouse gas emissions. But a slim majority of Republicans in this country remain opposed. And, of course, they've got a lot of votes on Capitol Hill right now. David Sandilow, how about you? What's your checklist? The finance part, $100 billion a year. Governments are saying we don't want to underwrite all that. Bill Gates can chip in there, somebody, but private money can't do the whole thing. Are governments going to commit to this $100 billion to go to poorer and poorer nations for mitigation and adaptation?
Yeah, the $100 billion is not just from governments. The $100 billion refers to a pledge from the Copenhagen Round of Negotiations that refers to both public and private money.
I got that, but isn't it going to have to be overwhelmingly public in the end?
Actually, I think it's going to have to be overwhelmingly private in the end, because almost all of the money in the energy sector around the world comes from the private sector. And there's no way that we can scale up the type of resources that we need primarily from the public sector. There will be areas where the public sector is going to play an important role, particularly for so-called adaptation funding. But most of this money is going to be private sector money, and that means finding ways to get capital to developing countries where it's needed.
Capital for infrastructure, for new energy infrastructure. Over the weekend, we also read Robert Stavins and Peter Thiel saying, look, if you're serious about bringing down carbon emission, it's got to be nuclear. Is that anywhere on the table here?
Well, so that's up to the individual countries. I think it ought to be on the table. And that's up to the individual countries in terms of how they're going to domestically achieve emissions reductions. In the U.S., it is officially on the table under the Clean Power Plan. Nuclear power in the final version of the rule is somewhat disadvantaged. But under any carbon pricing mechanism, nuclear power is tremendously favored because it's zero carbon. So nuclear power and renewables with carbon pricing will begin to find their own day.
There you've got your nuclear waste, but then you get into the whole realm of lesser of evils. That's a conversation for another day. I'm thinking we will have it here. Robert Stavins at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard with the Harvard Project on Climate Agreements. Good luck in Paris. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
John, Jack Cushman, editor and reporter for Inside Climate News in Paris right now. Jack, good luck there. Be safe, and we'll look for your reports.
Thank you.
David Sandilow, are you missing the action here? You've been right in the inner sanctum of all these for so long.
I'm enjoying this enormously, and I'm headed to Paris over the weekend. I'll be there for the second week, but I won't be staying up all night as a negotiator.
All right. The whole world in Paris will be watching. Thanks for joining us from Columbia today and the Center on Global Energy Policy. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.